council free rein to rummage through the other crates in the remaining wagons and split it up among them, and then walked back over to us. He threw a small pouch to Caden that jingled when it landed in his palm.
"Take her to the Jehendra and get her some suitable clothes."
I looked at the Komazar suspiciously. His brows rose innocently, and he raked his long, dark locks from his face. He looked like a boy of 17 instead of a man nearly 30. A dragon of many faces. And how well he wore them.
"Don't worry, princess," he said. "Just a gift from me to you."
Then why did it create a breath-sucking hollow in my stomach? Why the turnaround from a sack dress to a gift of new clothing? He always seemed to be a step ahead of me, knowing just how to push me off kilter. Gifts always came with a price. A soldier brought him his horse as a whole squad waited for him at the gate. He took the reins, called his goodbyes, then added,
"Caden, you're the keep in my absence. Walk with me to the gate. I have a few things to tell you."
I watched them walk away, the Komazar's arm slung over Caden's shoulder, their heads nodding, conspiring. A frightening shiver skipped through me as if I were seeing ghosts. They could be my own brothers, Regan and Bryn, walking through the halls of Civica confiding a secret. The small wedge I had planted was already disappearing. They had a history together. Loyalty. The Komazar called him brother, as if they really were. I knew, even minutes ago when I had called Caden an ally, that he wasn't. Not as long as Venda came first.
Chapter 13. Caden.
"She speaks the language well. How is that possible?" He hadn't shown his surprise last night when she spoke. He wouldn't. Surprise in front of the council wasn't his way. In truth, I think he was rarely surprised by anything. But I heard it in his voice now. It was strange that I should feel a sense of pride. Just as I had underestimated Leah when I began tracking her, he had underestimated her too. Most royals barely knew where Venda was, much less spoke the tongue. "She's gifted at languages," I explained, "and our time crossing the Cam Lantau gave her plenty of opportunity to study ours." He sighed dramatically.
"Another gift? The princess is full of them. Though I haven't seen evidence of the one you claim yet. I wouldn't call that dizzy-eyed performance last night anything but a sham, though maybe a useful one."
He left his last thought hanging in the air. A sham, his preference, because that he could control.
"I'll be gone a few weeks, no more. But if Tierney still hasn't shown by the time I get back, it doesn't bode well for him. It will be your turn to ride with a show of force and see if we have a challenger who needs to be brought into the fold. We can't have renegade governors when so much is at stake, especially with the critical supplies we need coming from Arleston."
"Tierney is always late."
"Late or not, when I return, you go. And without her. Remember what I said. We aren't cocks guarding hens. We are the Ratan."
The Ratan. I was 11 the first time I repeated those words back to him. Younger even than Eben. By then, I had been under his protection for a year. He'd made sure I got double portions of food. At that point, my eyes were no longer sunken, the hollows in my cheeks had filled out, and meat was back on my scarred ribs. I had said the words with all the pride I heard in his voice now. "We are the Ratan, the United Brothers, dauntless and enduring.
From that moment, he had begun grooming me to become the next assassin. I was awed and grateful for the trust he gave me. My loyalty to him was probably greater than anyone's. He had slaughtered many to save my skinny bones. I owed him everything. He was the assassin back then. 3 assassins had come and gone since, none of them surviving more than a few years. At the age of 15, I was the youngest ever to claim the position. That was 4 years ago.
How much blood do you have on your hands, Caden? How many people have you killed?
I couldn't answer Leah because I didn't know the numbers. I knew only gurgled breaths. The half-gasps that came too late. The hands that were too slow to draw the weapon poised at their side. I knew the startled eyes that took a piece of me with them before they closed. They had grown into one faceless blur. All I knew was that they were traitors who had infiltrated other kingdoms to escape justice, or officers at outposts, whose attacks were relentless and brutal, and who hunted down families like Ebens that tried to settle in the Cam Lanteau. But the work of an assassin could only instill fear in the enemy, and perhaps slow the attacks. A marching army could stop them for good. The Komazar stopped several yards short of the gate.
"We can't let weakness take hold, and that brings me to my next matter," he said. 3 soldiers ran. We found them hiding with a camp of vagabonds. The vagabonds were dealt with for sheltering them, but the soldiers were brought back."
"Vagabonds? Which ones?"
"In the forests, north of Rulao."
I took an easier breath. I shouldn't have been relieved that any vagabonds had perished, but I had a special fondness for Dihara and her clan. I knew Dihara was too smart to harbor traitors. Most vagabonds were. News of the harsh consequences meted out to a few traveled like wind through vagabond camps. He told me the execution would be at the 3rd bell in front of comrade soldiers, and I was to call the count. Though a Chievdar carried out the executions and staking, the Komazar, or the keep, always gave the last interrogation, always called to the troops who witnessed for a yea or nay, always gave the final instruction for them to lay their heads on the block, always gave the final nod. The count, it was called, the final steps that dealt justice.
"But remember, don't kill them too quickly. It goes a long way toward discouraging similar actions. Make sure they suffer. You'll take care of that, right, brother?"
I looked at him, nodded. I always met my duty. He gave me a hearty hug and walked away, but after only a few steps, he paused again and turned.
"Oh, and make sure you feed the emissary. I think Ulrich will conveniently forget, and I don't want to return to a corpse. I'm not done with our royal ambassador. Yet."
Chapter 14.
I spotted Grizz leading a horse out of the stable. With Cadence and the Komazar's backs still to me, I hurried over to intercept him. He saw me coming and stopped, his ever-present scowl receding. "May I speak to you?" I asked, privately. He looked to each side.
"We're as alone as we're going to get."
I had no time for diplomacy. "Are you a spy?" I asked bluntly. He stepped forward, his chin tucked to his chest.
"No more talk of that,"
he grumbled low. His eyes darted to nearby governors talking in groups of 3 or 4.
"I did you a favor, girl. You saved my life and that of my comrades. I pay my debts. We're even now."
"I don't believe that's all it was, Grizz. I saw your face. You cared."
Don't make it out to be more than it was.
But I still need your help.
We're done, Princess. Do you understand that?
But we couldn't be done. I still needed more help. I could reveal to them all that you speak fluent Morrigese, I threatened. I was desperate for his help, even if I had to blackmail him to get it.
And if you did that, you'd be condemning my whole family to death. 36 of them. Brothers, sisters, cousins, their children. More than that whole company of men you watched die. Is that what you want?
36. I searched his scarred face and saw fear, true and real. I shook my head. No, I whispered. That's not what I want. I felt my hopes slump with another door closed. Your secret is safe.
And yours is as well.
At least I had confirmation that he knew Rafe's true identity. I was grateful that Grizz had covered for him, but we needed so much more. I opened my mouth to ask for one last bit of information, but he turned brusquely, his elbow deliberately catching my ribs. I doubled over, falling to one knee. He leaned down, a snarl on his face, but his voice was low and even.
"We're being watched," he whispered. "Snap back at me."
"You stupid oaf!" I yelled. "Watch where you're going!"
"That's right," he whispered. "One bit of advice I can give you. You'd be wise to friend Aster. The urchin knows every crevice of the sanctum as well as any mouse."
He straightened and glared down at me.
"Then stay out of my way,"
he bellowed as he stormed away. A group of nearby governors laughed. I glanced across the yard and saw it was Caden who was watching us. He walked over and asked what Grizz had wanted. "Nothing," I answered. He was only grunting and drooling over the Hall of Goods like everyone else.
"With good reason," Caden answered. "It might be the last for a long while. Winter is near."
He made it sound like a door slamming shut. In Civica, there wasn't a big difference between winter and summer. A few degrees, stronger winds, a heavier cloak, and rain. But it wasn't enough to stop commerce or traffic. And by my calculations, winter was still at least 2 months off. We were only just entering autumn, the last bloom of summer. Surely winter couldn't come any earlier to Venda than it did to Civica. But I felt the chill in the air, the tired glint of sun, already different from yesterday. Winter is near. Enough doors were already closed to me. I couldn't let this one shut, too. I followed Caden through the square to a gate that led out of the sanctum. He was taking me to the Jehendra to get suitable clothes, as the Komazar had ordered. I stayed close to him, fearing the people outside the gates as much as those within. It was a mixed blessing to have the Komazar gone. It gave me breathing room, little past his notice, but it also meant he was out of my reach. I wanted to ask Caden about Rafe, where he was, and how he had fared through the night, but I knew that would only make him doubt my pronouncement that I wanted nothing to do with the emissary, and if Caden was suspicious, the Komazar would be too. I prayed the guards hadn't shown Rafe more of their distaste for Dalbrecht's wine. Maybe after last night's dinner and the Komazar's frequent attentions toward him, they would show more restraint. We walked side by side, but I noticed an occasional limp in Caden's gait. "I'm sorry about the leg," I said.
"As you said, there are no rules when it comes to survival. Your brothers taught you well."
I swallowed the tender knot in my throat. "Yes, they did."
"They taught you to throw the knife, too?"
I had nearly forgotten about Finch and my near bullseye on his chest.
Caden obviously hadn't. My brothers taught me a lot of things, mostly just by being with them, watching and absorbing.
What else have you absorbed?
I guess you'll have to find out.
I'm not so sure my shins want to know.
I grinned. I think your shins are safe for now. He cleared his throat.
I apologize for my tone with you this morning. I know I was
arrogant, condescending, dismissive.
He nodded. But you know I don't feel that way about you. It's a language that's become part of me after so many years. Especially now that I'm back here.
Why? Are you ever going to tell me why you hate royals so? When you haven't ever known any but me?
I've known nobility, if not royalty. There isn't much difference.
Of course you have, I mocked. An assassin in court rubbing elbows with lords and ladies happens every day. Name names. Just one noble that you've met.
This way, he said, grabbing my arm to lead me down an alleyway, using our sudden turn as a way to avoid my question. I suspected his answer was that he had known none, but he didn't want to admit it. He hated royals because all Vendans did. They were expected to, especially certain powerful Vendans.
Just so you know, Caden, your revered leader plans to kill me. He told me so. Caden shook his head and held up the bag of coins the Komazar had tossed to him as if it were evidence to the contrary.
He's not going to kill you.
Perhaps he just wants me well-dressed when I'm hanging from the end of a rope.
The Komazar doesn't hang people. He beheads them.
Oh, well, that's a relief. Thank you for enlightening me.
He's not going to kill you, Leah, he repeated. Unless you do something stupid.
He stopped and grabbed my arm.
You're not going to do something stupid, are you?
Passers-by stopped and watched us. I realized they all recognized the assassin. They knew who he was and gave him respectful distance. I studied Caden. Stupid was all a matter of perspective. I'm only doing what you asked, following your lead and trying to convince others of my gift. He leaned in close, lowering his voice.
Use your displays sparingly, Leah. And never hold it over the Komazar's head like you did with Grizz and Finch. You'll feel the backlash if you do. Let him use your gift as he sees fit.
Help him perpetrate a sham, you mean?
And I'll repeat your own words. There are no rules when it comes to survival.
What if it's not a sham? His expression darkened. I realized that in all our time across the Camlento, he had never once conceded that I might really have a gift, not even when I warned him about the bison stampede. Strangely, he used rumor of my gift as an excuse to keep me alive without admitting any belief in it himself.
Just do as he asks, Caden finally said.
I offered a grudging nod, and we continued walking. It was almost as if he had a deeper regard for the gift than Grizz and Finch. Was it the potential power it held that neither he nor the Komazar could control? Dihara would laugh at the idea of using the gift as the Komazar saw fit. She had balked when I suggested it. The gift cannot be summoned. It is just that, a gift, a delicate way of knowing, a way as old as the universe itself. A small sigh escaped my lips. Delicate. Oh, how I wish it were a heavy spiked mace that I could wield instead. Caden went on to explain that the Komazar's threats were only his way of establishing boundaries and power with me. A little respect from me could go a long way. And his bag of coin is a bribe? Like the stolen wine he gives to the governors. Is he trying to buy my respect? Caden looked sideways at me.
The Komazar has no need to buy anything. You should know that by now.
The clothes I have on are just fine. I rather like your shirt and trousers. As do I, and my wardrobe isn't limitless. Besides, it swims on you, and if the Komazar wants you to have new clothes, you'll have new clothes. You don't want to insult his generosity. You said you wanted to understand my world. The Jahendra will open your eyes to more of it. Generosity? I tried to keep from choking. But Caden had a certain blindness when it came to the Komazar. Or maybe he simply had the same unrealistic hope that Wraith had in his army of four, that together, against all odds, they could make everything right that was wrong in their world. I trudged along next to him, swallowing my skepticism of the Komazar's generosity, because understanding Caden's world, which included the Jahendra, just might help me get out of this godforsaken place. I probed about other things. He said you were the keep in his absence. What does that mean?
Not much. If a decision must be made while he's gone, it falls to me.
That sounds like an important job.
Not usually. The Komazar keeps a tight rein on affairs that concern Venda. But sometimes a quarter lord can't settle a dispute, or a patrol has to be sent out.
You can give orders to raise the bridge?
Only if necessary. And it won't be necessary.
The Venden loyalty was thick in his tone. We walked silently, and I took in his city, its hum filling my ears. It was the sound of thousands of people pressed too close, a rising rumble of tasks that were laced with urgency. Eyes raked over us from doorways and patched together hovels. I felt the gazes on our backs long after we passed. I was sure they somehow knew I was an outsider. When the alley narrowed, Venden's traveling in the opposite direction had to squeeze past us, and the bones on their belts clattered against the stone walls. People seemed to crowd every inch of this endless city. The stories that they bred like rabbits didn't seem far-fetched. The alleyway finally opened up onto a wider street that buzzed with more people. The tall surrounding structures blocked the sun, and ramshackle huts balanced precariously on their ledges. The city was woven of a weft and warp that defied reason. Sometimes only a canvas wall trembling in the wind defined a living space. People lived where they could, overflowing dark smoky lanes and whittling out a space to call home. Children followed after us, offering horse patties for fires, amulets strung on leather, or mice that wriggled in their pockets. Mice as pets? Would anyone actually pay for such a thing? But when one little boy described his as plump and meaty, I realized they weren't being sold for pets. We walked for at least a mile before we reached a large open market. This was the Jahendra. It was the widest open space I had seen in the city thus far, as large as three tourney fields. Only a few permanent structures filled it. The rest were sewn together like a colorful quilt. Some stalls were no more than an overturned crate to sell the smallest trinket. Bells, drums, and the strings of a zitare strummed the air in a jangling beat that matched the city. We passed a stall with skinned lambs hanging from hooks, flies getting the first taste. A little farther down, shallow clay pots brimming with powdered herbs were set out on blankets, women offering a pinch for free to lure us their way. Across the aisle, three-sided tents showed off piles of clothing, some of it threadbare and torn. Other stalls had freshly woven fabrics that seemed to rival those brought in on the provisi wagons. Cages of scrawny, bald doves cooed across rutted pathways to pens of fresh pink piglets. I saw row after row of wares, from food to pottery to darker shops in the permanent structures that offered unseen pleasures behind drawn curtains. In contrast to this city painted in soot and weariness, the Jahendra teemed with color and life. Though he said nothing, I felt Caden studying me when I stopped at stalls and examined the goods. Was he fearful I would use the word barbarian with the same distaste as I had crossing the Camlento? Some of the offerings were the humblest of efforts, rags twisted into dolls, or balls of rendered fat tied up in animal entrails. I was tempted to spend the Komazar's coin on all manner of things besides clothing, and it was hard to walk away when earnest faces were hopeful I would buy their goods. I walked through a stall of talismans. Flat blue stones inlaid with white stars seemed to be the favored design, sometimes with a splash of red stone bleeding from the center. And I wondered if it hailed back to the story of the angel Aster. I remembered what Caden had said, that the one thing Venda was not short of was rock and metal. At least some Vendans didn't seem to be short on memory, either. Their stories of history might not be accurate, but at least they had them. And some, like these artisans, revered them enough to fashion jewelry into remembrances. That was one thing I hadn't heard this morning in Venda. The singing of remembrances that always greeted mornings throughout Morrigan. I'd never thought I would miss them, but maybe I just missed those who sang them. Pauline, Bertie, my brothers. Even my father never missed morning remembrances, singing of the braveries of Morrigan and the steadfastness of the chosen remnant. I rubbed my thumb across the amulet. The inlaid star a remembrance as carefully wrought as any musical note.
"Here," Caden said, and he flipped the merchant a coin. "She'll take that one."
The merchant put the talisman around my neck.
"I knew you'd take it," he whispered in my ear.
He stepped back, his gaze fixed on mine. His manner set me on edge, but perhaps it was the way of Venden merchants to be so familiar.
"Wear it in good health," he said.
"I will. Thank you." We continued down the path, Caden leading the way, until we came to several tents in a row with clothing and fabrics hanging from poles.
"One of those should have something for you," he said. "I'll wait here."
He sat on the end of an empty cart and folded his arms, nodding toward the tents. I walked past them nonchalantly, not sure which one to go into, especially since I had no interest in finding something suitable to wear. I perused from a distance, not committing to stepping inside any of them, but then I heard a small voice.
"Miz! Miz!"
From the darkness of a tent, a hand reached out and grabbed mine, pulling me inside. I sucked in a startled breath, but saw it was Aster. I asked what she was doing here, and she said this was her papa's shop.
"Not his shop proper, but he works here sometimes, lifting things too heavy for Ephira. Not today, though, because he's sick, so he sent me, but Ephira doesn't much think that someone my size..."
Aster clapped her hand over her mouth.
"I'm sorry, miss. There I go again. It doesn't matter why I'm here. Why are you here?"
"Because I was yanked into your tent," I wanted to tease, but I knew Aster was self-conscious, and I didn't want to add to her insecurity. "The Komazar says I need suitable clothes." Her eyes grew wide, as if the Komazar himself were standing there, and in the same instant, a squat woman bustled into the middle of the tent from behind a curtain stretched across the back.
"You came to the right place, then. I know just what he likes. I have..."
I set her straight immediately. I wasn't one of the Komazar's special visitors. Aster enthusiastically offered more details about who I was.
"She just got here. She's a princess. She came from a faraway land, and her name is Jezalia, but..."
"Hush, girl!"
The woman looked back at me, chewing on something tucked inside her cheek, and I wondered if she was going to spit at me now that she knew I came from the other side. She studied me for a long while.
"I think I have just what you need."
She judged my measurements with a practiced eye and said she'd return shortly. She ordered Aster to keep me company in the meantime. As soon as Ephira was gone, Aster squeezed her head through a slit in the side of the tent and let out a deafening whistle. In seconds, two bone-thin children smaller than Aster slipped through the flap. Like Aster, their hair was cut short to the scalp, and I wasn't sure if they were boys or girls, but their eyes were wide and hungry. Aster introduced the smaller one as Yvette, and the other was a boy named Zakiah. I noticed he was missing the tip of his forefinger on his left hand. The stump was red and swollen, as if the injury had happened only recently, and he rubbed it self-consciously with his other hand. At first they were too shy to speak, but then Yvette asked in a shaky voice if I had really been to other lands, as Aster claimed. Aster looked at me with expectant eyes as if her reputation lay on the line. "Yes, what Aster says is true," I said. "Would you like to hear about them?" They nodded eagerly, and we all sat on the rug in the middle of the tent. I told them about forgotten cities in the middle of nowhere, savannas of copper grass that spread as wide as a sea, glittering ruins that shimmered for miles, meadows high in the mountains where the stars were so close you could touch their sparkling tails, and an old woman who spun star shimmer into thread on a great spinning wheel. I told them of bearded animals with heads like anvils that rode together in groups more numerous than the pebbles in a river, and of a mysterious tumbled city where springs flowed with water as sweet as nectar, streets gleamed gold, and the ancients still cast their magic.
"Is that where you're from?" Yvette asked.
I looked at her, not sure how to answer. Where was I from? Strangely, it wasn't Civica that came to mind. "No," I finally whispered. And then I told them about Terravin. "Once upon a time," I said, making it into a story as distant and removed as it now felt, "there was a princess, and her name was Arabella. She had to flee a terrible dragon that was chasing her, intending to make her his breakfast. She ran to a village that offered her protection." I told them of a bay as bright as sapphires, silver fish that jumped into nets, a woman who stirred up bottomless pots of stew, and cottages woven of rainbows and flowers, a land as magical as any princess could ever dream up. But then the dragon found her again, and she had to leave.
"Will the princess ever go back?"
a new voice asked. I looked up to my left, startled. Four more children had slipped in and crouched on their knees at the entrance of the tent. "I think she'll try," I answered. Ephira breezed in from behind, clapping her hands and shooing them off. "Here we go," she said, and I turned to see three more women standing at the back of the tent, their arms piled with fabrics. Among them were soft leathers of every shade, tans, browns, and fawns, and some dyed in purples, greens, and reds. Another woman held accessories like belts, scarves, and scabbards in her arms. My heart pounded, and I wasn't sure why, but then I knew, before they even unfolded them. Barbarian clothes. These weren't like the ones Calantha wore, made of light and delicate fabrics, brought in on Pravizi caravans. I looked at Ephira uncertainly. Her expression was resolute. I was sure it wasn't what the Komazar had in mind, but somehow these fabrics seemed right. It was the same strange feeling I had felt the first time I rounded the bend and saw Terravin. A feeling of rightness. Clothing, of course,
was not the same as a home, I reminded myself. All I need is something simple, trousers and a shirt, clothes I can ride in, I said.
And that you'll have, and a simple change of clothes as well, Ephira answered,
and with a quick wave of her hand, the women moved in, a whirl of motion, and began measuring and pinning together a basic riding outfit. Caden and I walked back toward the sanctum. Ephira promised to send the two outfits I had ordered with Aster later today, after a few alterations had been made. The fear I had carried ever since I had crossed the bridge into Venda was momentarily lifted. My brief time in the tent, first with the children, and then with the women as they held up fabrics, vests, shirts, and trousers, was a soothing balm. I felt less like an outsider, and I hoped I could hang on to that feeling. It seems foolish to spend money on clothing when there's so much need elsewhere, I said, still questioning the Komazar's loose purse. How do you think Vendans go about their everyday lives? They have jobs and professions and mouths to feed. I gave Ephira twice what she would get from anyone else. Making clothing is how she survives.
Ephira, do you know every shopkeeper's name in Venda?
No, just hers.
So you've brought other young ladies to her?
As a matter of fact, I have.
He didn't elaborate, and his silence made me wonder who they were. More visitors of the Komazars, or young ladies of his own fancy?
Why are we going back already? I asked. It's still early. I thought you wanted me to see your city. I've seen only a small part.
The Komazar has some matters for me to look after in the Tomac Quarter.
Isn't that what the Quarter Lords are for?
Not this matter. It has to do with soldiers.
I could go along with you.
No.
His reply came hot and clipped, and not like Caden at all. I turned and gave him a long, dissecting stare.
I'll take you back another way, he offered. Past some of the more interesting ruins.
A compromise, because whatever was in this Tomac Quarter, he didn't want me to see it. Again, we traveled down narrow lanes, alleyways, and some paths that seemed little more than rabbit trails, jumping over rain-washed gullies and slipping on trampled dead grass. We came at last to a wide, well-traveled street, and Caden walked me over to a large cauldron bubbling over a fire. There were rough wooden benches scattered in a circle around it, and an old man offered mugs of the brew for a modest price.
"It's Thanis," Caden said. "A tea brewed from a weed."
He bought one for each of us, and we sat down on one of the benches.
"Thanis is another thing that Venda has in abundance," he explained. "It grows almost anywhere. Ledges, cracks, the rockiest of fields. Sometimes the farmers curse it. Once it takes hold, it's hard to stop it from spreading. Thanis is a survivor, like a Vendan."
He said the leaves were purple, sprouting bright above the snows of winter, but in late autumn, for only a few days before seeding, it changed to bright gold. That was when it turned sweet, but also to poison.
"A drink of the golden Thanis will be your last."
I was glad to see ours was a strange purplish brew and not golden. I took a sip and spit it out. It tasted like dirt. Sour, horrible, moldy dirt. Caden laughed.
"It's an acquired taste, but a tradition in Venda, like the bones worn on our belts. It's said that Thanis was all that kept Lady Venda and the early clans here alive those first few winters. In truth, it's probably all that kept me alive more than one winter. When other supplies run out, there's always Thanis."
I braved another sip and forced a swallow down, then immediately tried to summon saliva to my mouth to wash the taste away. I was sure it wasn't a taste I'd ever acquire, not even in the bleakest of winters. I glanced up at the old man stirring the cauldron,
singing a chant to passers-by.
"Than is for the heart, than is for the mind, than is for the soul, than is, live long, children of Venda."
He repeated it over and over, a snaking song with no beginning or end. Hovering above the steam of the cauldron, I spotted someone standing on a distant high ledge, watching me. A woman. Her figure seemed to ripple through the steam, hazy, fading, and then she vanished. She was simply gone. I blinked and looked down at my steaming cup of brew.
"Just what's in this?" I asked.
Caden smiled. "Only a harmless weed, I promise."
He called to the old man and asked him if he had any cream to sweeten my drink. He happily obliged, for though he nearly gave the Thanis away, the cream, honey, or spirits to flavor it came at a greater cost. Even with a hefty dosing of cream, the Thanis was only marginally palatable. The spirits might have helped more. We sipped our drinks and watched children chasing after those who passed by, begging to do anything that might bring something in trade.
"They seem so young. Where are their parents?" I asked.
"Most have none, or their parents are on another street corner doing the same."
"Can't you do something for them?"
"I'm trying, Leah. So is the Komazar. But he can butcher only so many horses.
And raid so many caravans.
There are other ways of managing a kingdom."
He glanced at me, a smirk on his lips.
"Are there?"
His gaze turned back to the street.
When the ancient treaties were drawn and borders established, Venda was not part of those negotiations. The fertile lands of Venda were always few, and each year more fields have fallen fallow. Most of the countryside of Venda is far poorer than what you see here, which is why the city grows. They come searching for hope and a better life.
"Is this how you grew up? On the streets of Venda?"
He swilled down the last of his Thanis and rose to return the mug to the old man.
"No, I would have been lucky if I had."
"Lucky? Are your parents that bad?"
He stopped mid-step.
"My mother was a saint."
"Was." I stared at him, a raised vein snaking at his temple. This was it. His weakness. The buried part of him that he refused to share. His parents.
"We need to go."
He put his hand out, waiting for my empty mug. I wanted more answers, but I knew what it was like to ache with memories of a mother and father. My own mother had deceived me, trying to thwart my gift, and my father? My stomach squeezed. It was only a single small notice in the village square. Walther had told me that as if it might comfort me, but the notice was still a call for my arrest and return for treason, posted by my own father. Some lines should never be crossed, and he proved it when he hanged his own nephew. I still didn't know what role my father had played in the bounty hunter's attempt on my life. Maybe he'd seen it as a convenient way to eliminate a messy court hearing altogether. He knew my brothers would never forgive him if he executed me.
"Leah, your mug?"
I shook off the memory, handing him the mug, and we continued on our way. Here, as in the savannah, ruin and renewal lay side by side, and sometimes it was impossible to discern one from the other. A massive dome that must once have topped a great temple was sunk in rubble, and only a glimmer of carved stone peeked through the earth to reveal that it was more than a mound in the landscape. Next to it, stone was piled upon stone, creating a pen for a goat. Animals were carefully guarded here, Caden told me. They tended to disappear. We walked on for a long way until Caden finally stopped at one unassuming ruin,
resting his hand on a tree that engulfed one wall like gnarled fingers. This one used to reach higher than any tower in Venda.
How would anyone know?
I looked at the partial walls that formed an enormous square. Trees grew atop the remains like twisted sentries. None of the actual remains were more than a dozen feet high anymore, and one wall was almost entirely gone. It seemed a fanciful notion to suppose that it once towered over the entire city. It may have been only the walls of a manor, I said. It wasn't, Caden said firmly. It rose almost 600 feet into the sky. 600 feet? I grunted my disbelief. Documents were found that confirm it. As best as they can decipher, this was a monument to one of their leaders. I didn't really know much about the ancients' history before the devastation. Little was recorded in the Morrigan Holy Text, mostly just the aftermath. We knew only of their demise, and the scholars had collected the few relics that survived the centuries. Paper documents were rare. Paper was the first thing to crumble away, and according to the Holy Text, when the ancients were trying to survive, it was the first thing they used for fuel. Survival trumped words. Ancient documents that had been interpreted were even more rare. The scholars of Morrigan had years of schooling in such things. The Vendans seemed barely able to keep their people fed, never mind educating them in other tongues. How would they accomplish such an enormous task? I looked back at the monument that had supposedly reached to the sky, now almost totally unrecognizable as anything man-made. Weeds choked every surface. A monument to a leader? Who had the ancients wanted to immortalize? Whoever it was, the angel Aster, by order of the gods, had wiped it from memory. I thought about the ancient texts I had stolen from the royal scholar, still in my saddlebag, which was probably for sale in the Jehendra by now. I'd probably never see the precious texts again, and I'd had time to translate only a single passage of the last testaments of Gaudrell. Were the rest of her words lost to me now? Maybe it didn't matter anymore. But as I gazed at the monument, the few words I had translated rang as clear as if Gaudrell whispered them to me now. The things that last, the things that remain. This great monument wasn't one of those things.
There's another down this way, and then we'll go back, Caden said.
I looked to where he pointed. Great slabs of white shone in the distance. When we reached them, he said tunnels beneath the city had revealed that the ruin was mostly buried. Only the upper portion was exposed. These ruins were not from a tower, but a temple of a different sort. At its center was the enormous sculpted head and partial shoulders of a man. The face was not the perfect face of a god, nor that of an idealized soldier. It was oddly proportioned. Forehead too wide, nose too large, protruding cheekbones that made him look starved. Maybe that was why I couldn't turn away. He was like a tribute to a people he would never know, someone from another time chiseled with the same hunger and want as those who lived here now. I reached up and ran my fingers over his cracked cheekbone, wondering who he was and why the ancients wanted him remembered. Broken slabs of the surrounding temple lay on the ground near him. One large piece was engraved, but most of the words had been melted away by time. The faint indentations of a few letters survived. I couldn't read it, but my finger traced the grooves, committing the forgotten lines to memory. F. R. E. V. R. I was struck with sadness looking at the forlorn figure and lost words. For the first time, I felt a sliver of gratitude for my hours spent studying the Morrigan Holy Text
so that truth and history wouldn't be lost again. We should go, Caden said. We'll take another path, a faster way back. I stepped away from the monument and looked around, waiting for his lead. We had taken so many turns, I wasn't sure which direction we even needed to go. And then it hit me, like open hands slapped against my shoulders, waking me up. I stared at Caden, realizing what he was doing. He wasn't just kindly obliging me and showing me more of Venda. This had been part of his plan all along. He was deliberately confusing me. And it was working. I had no idea where the sanctum was from here. He didn't want me becoming familiar with the tangle of streets, so he was taking yet another route back. The twists and turns and alleyways we followed weren't shortcuts. They were obstacles to finding my own way around this maze of a city. I turned around, looking in different directions, trying to get my bearings. It was impossible. "You still don't trust me," I said. His jaw was set, his eyes dark stone. "My problem is, Leah, I know you too well. Like the day you used the bison stampede to separate us. You're always looking for opportunity. You barely made it that day. If you tried something like that here, you wouldn't make it at all. Trust me." "Swim across the river? I'm not that stupid. What else would I try?" He looked at me as if he was genuinely puzzled. "I don't know." "There are no rules when it comes to survival," I reminded myself as I moved toward him. Each step was sharp-edged steel cutting through me. But I took his hand in mine and squeezed it tenderly. Felt his warmth and strength, his uncanny knowing. "Have you considered that maybe I'm trying to view the opportunities right before me?" I said softly. "And I'm not looking for anything else?" He stared at me for what seemed a lifetime, and then his hand tightened on my fingers and he pulled me close. His other hand pressed low on my back, holding me snugly against him, only our breath, time, and secrets between us. "I hope so," he finally whispered, and then, with his face only inches from mine, he released me and said it was time to go back.
Chapter 15. Wraith.
The water in the basin ran red. I squeezed the rag out and lifted it to my mouth again. It seemed to be Ulrich who hated me the most. I winced as I dabbed my lip where he had split it, then pressed hard trying to stop the bleeding. Pain radiated across my face. After the Commissar bid his farewell to me this morning, he sent his oversized brute in with some food, but Ulrich and his henchmen gave me an additional side dish. If every meal came with a bonus like that, I was in trouble. At least they hadn't aimed for my ribs again. I was sure at least one was cracked. I couldn't afford more. It was ironic that all I had wanted was the chance to prove myself as a soldier, and now I was forced to play an untrained and inept emissary when I was matched against brutish clods. Hand combat wasn't my strongest suit, but I could have taken them down in just a few moves with no one the wiser. Sparing my lip wasn't worth risking the plan, though. 2 years ago, when Tavish and I had disobeyed orders and rescued his brother from an enemy camp, we had played drunken, weaponless bumblers. That deception had to work for only a few minutes before we revealed our true purpose. This one would have to last much longer. This time there were no horses waiting. There was no quick escape. My story had given us time, and I had to continue to make them believe it. The Commissar had bought into it for now. My proposal had played to his ego. He wanted to believe that a powerful kingdom was at last recognizing him as a worthy ally, that the prince was actually coming to him to negotiate an alliance. He believed he was finally getting the trembling respect he deserved, and who better to get it from than the future king of Dalbrek. He may have feigned suspicion, but I saw the hunger in his eyes when I laid it out. There was only one thing that someone with great power wanted. More of it. I knew firsthand. The marriage alliance with Morrigan hadn't been about protection and strength alone. That may very well have been the least of it. My father and his generals had little respect for the Morrigese army. They considered them weak and favored only by some strategic positions and resources. The alliance had also been a bid for dominance. My father and his cabinet believed that once we had the beloved first daughter of Morrigan within our borders, boundaries could be pushed. After acquiring Princess Arabella, the southern port of Piadro in Morrigan was next in their sights, though the cabinet preferred to use the word dowry. Only a small port and a few hills. But for Dalbrek, having a deep water western port would increase their power tenfold. It was also a matter of pride. In another time, the port and surrounding lands had belonged to Brek, the exiled prince of Morrigan, banished from the kingdom for challenging his ruling brother. Though countless centuries had passed since then, Dalbrek still wanted it back. Some wounds never healed. They saw Leah as a diplomatic inroad to getting what they believed was rightfully theirs without mounting an outright invasion. When I mentioned the desire for the port to the Commissar, it rang true for him, not just because he knew the port's value, but because the quest for more power was a hunger he understood. Last night, he had fished for details of the court of Dalbrek, as if he was already planning for his meeting with the prince. I didn't take him for a fool, though. He wouldn't be misled forever. I knew enough of the reputations of Vendun riders, their swift flight, and the way they slipped through borders with ease. It wouldn't be long before they returned with news of my father's good health. Leah and I had to be gone before then. The brute of a fellow who had identified me was a concern, though. Grizz, the Commissar had called him. Had he lied for me, or was he truly confused? Maybe he had seen me up on the dais at a ceremony and mistaken me for one of many dignitaries there. He was a loose end that I didn't feel good about, and he was one mountain of a loose end. I dropped the rag into the basin and grabbed a dry one. Only a thin smear of blood stained the white cloth when I dabbed my mouth. The flow was stopped, but my lips still throbbed. I walked over to the tall slit of a window, just shy of being wide enough for me to slip through, and I pushed open the shutter. Pigeons fluttered from the wet ledge. Far below, Venda crawled awake like a lumbering giant. Walls and towers prevented me from seeing much past a few rooftops, but the city appeared to spread for miles. It was far larger than I had expected. I leaned as far forward as the narrow window would allow. Were Sven and the others already slinking down one of those dark streets? Rafe's plans going to kill us all. Orin may have voiced their thoughts, but none of them hesitated to do as I asked. Tavish even whispered before I rode off, "We've done it before. We can do it again." But that time we had faced only a dozen, not thousands, and none had been the Commissar. I turned away and paced the room, trying to think of anything but Leah. I looked down at the cuts across my knuckles, my own stupidity. As soon as they had brought me to my room last night and shut the door, I had punched the wall without thinking. Reckless actions like that were not part of the plan either. Sven would have reprimanded me for acting with my heart instead of my head and putting a potential weapon, my hand, at risk. But it had been all I could do to sit there and act like I didn't care when Leah kissed Caden. The only thing that had delayed my reaction was the message I had received loud and clear from Leah. The Komazar watched everything.